Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this Memorial Day weekend edition of the podcast, we'll hear from Stephen Lattimore about the new VFW post in Gary, and Jill Sheridan reports on what the Indy 500 is doing to help organ donors. We'll also hear from Nick Jansen about the conservation of bison in Indiana, along with John Kane on Eye in the Arts about the upcoming performance of Primal Roots. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. After being closed and inactive for 6 years, the Gary Veterans of Foreign Wars Post has reopened. They're looking to increase members and do more in the community. It'll mean much-needed help for vets who live in the city of Gary, who have for years gone without much-needed help getting valuable benefits they need. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore has the story.
VFW Post 2151 in Gary is now open and serving veterans' needs. The VFW Post has been back in operation for about a year after being closed for 6 years. The former commander died and the post was inactive. Victor Baker is the current commander. They recently had elections, though, and Baker is going up to the state level. They will have a new commander here in Gary. Now they are looking for new members. It's been tough going for veterans groups nationwide.
The Vietnam veterans have reached a stage where they're in their 50s and 60s and stuff. So there's a gap between the veteran, the older veterans and the younger veterans, the Desert Storm veterans, the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And there is it's almost a generation gap. The younger veterans look upon the older veterans as sitting around in a smoke-filled bar, telling war stories, where the younger veterans are more interested in, they got families and they got other things that they're interested in, and they're actively involved in the workforce, whereas the older veterans are retired and they don't have anything to do but sit around and chew the fat.
Baker says he has thousands of stories where the VFW made a difference for a veteran.
In fact, I can remember a kid I think it's about maybe 10 or 12 months ago, he wanted to go to school. But he had a general discharge, and he needed his discharge upgraded. They kicked this kid out. He came back from Afghanistan. He was a sniper, and he missed one AA meeting, and when he got some static from the first sergeant, he said, "Well, just let me out," and they gave him a general discharge, meaning that his benefits were suspended until he could get him upgraded as far as him using his educational benefits. Well, he was having a problem because he was having a problem paying for his schooling. So he wasn't able to continue to go to school without using those benefits. So it affected everything. In fact, I know he had a problem with his fiancée. I remember that because he came into the office with her and she was livid about him not being able to go to school. I think right now he's in his third year now. So he's doing well. But he was a sniper and he was a nice kid, really nice kid. Once I got into it and found out, I told them, "Look, we can straighten this out."
Vets like Walter Oliver and Russell Gilliam, Vietnam veterans, rejoined Post 2151 in Gary. Walter says it's his home away from home.
But we can enhance your lifestyle from what we know now. And our objectives are genuine, and help is on the way.
And then there are vets like Lonnie McDade, a Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and Iraqi Freedom vet who is the chaplain at the post. And then there is James Payday Thomas, a Vietnam-era veteran who was with the Airborne Infantry. He says he's proud to be a veteran. Payday likes the way veterans are now given the support that they deserve.
Not like us. We came home, we didn't get no good welcome. But I really appreciate everywhere I go now. I wear my own cap. Everybody say, "Why you wear your stuff?" But, you know, and people say, welcome home, soldier. Thanks for your service. And that do a lot for me because we didn't get that when I came home in 69, you know. But, I mean, and just being a soldier, that's something. You know, that's a big thing for me.
If you'd like more information about how to join the VFW Post 2151 in Gary, it's located at 1640 West 10th Place. That's at 11th and Grant. And the phone number is 219-944-4760. The phone number for VFW Post 2151 is 219-944-4760. In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Organ donation has become a mission for racing families during this year's Indianapolis 500, with the goal of increasing the number of registered donors. And through the process comes healing and hope. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan has more.
Taylor McLean was close to her brother Brian Clausen. He was an organ donor. McLean is working an Indiana Donor Network autograph session at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Fans have to show proof they are registered donors to get autographs from IndyCar drivers. Fan Matt Hensley says organ donation has directly impacted his life.
My uncle had a heart transplant about 20 years ago, and he's still doing great. So
Hensley is one of 74% of licensed drivers in Indiana who are registered donors. This is the second year for the Driven to Save Lives campaign, and family members of former race car drivers are leading the push to increase the number of organ and tissue donors during this year's 101st running of the Indianapolis 500. One of those families is Brian Clausen's. Last year, Clausen was trying to race in 200 races around the world, including the 500. He was on 117th when he suffered a life-threatening brain injury in a crash. He was put on life support at the hospital. His father, Tim Clausen, said the doctors told him his son wouldn't recover.
You know, and it's hard to really put into words what that moment is like when you find out that, your son is gone. But then to know that you're going to have to just sit there and live in that moment for, you know, up to 3 days was very tough.
When Tim Clausen found out his son was an organ donor, he dreaded the waiting period. It takes time for all the tests to be done and the preparation of the organs and tissue for donation. That seemed unfathomable at first to Clausen, but it ended up being an important part of his healing process.
It dawned on me that while we were, you know, in this devastating moment with our son, that there were, you know, five other families who were surrounding their loved ones and really celebrating this gift that was about to happen for them. And it was probably that moment that you know, definitely changed my life.
Wanting to do something positive, the Clausen family set out to get 500 donors, and the racing community and fans responded by signing up in droves. They now have more than 6,000 newly registered donors. The Indiana Donor Network is partnering the effort. President and CEO Kelly Hanner says the need is great.
Well, nationwide, there's about 118,000, close to 120,000 people waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. In Indiana alone, it's about 1,300 people.
The network is a statewide organ recovery organization, the bridge between the people who give and the people who wait. It also helps the families of the deceased.
We have a 13-month aftercare program where we follow families, providing them with grief material.
The Driven to Save Lives campaign started last year in Indy. Then rookie Stephen Wilson and the Indiana Donor Network started it to remember and honor his brother Justin Wilson, who died in a crash at a Pennsylvania racetrack in 2015. Justin was an organ donor, and Stephen says that still helps him through the grieving process.
It's not often that after someone's passed that you get to talk about them that much, and for me it's been really healing because I've got to talk about Justin a lot, and I love talking about him. You know, honoring what his final act, really. I mean, saving five lives is incredible.
Together, Justin Wilson and Brian Clausen saved 10 lives through organ donation. Clausen's tissue donation will be able to heal up to 75 people. Their pictures are posted on the walls of the Driven to Save Lives garage at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Lindsay Johnson is with the communications team. She reads part of what is written about Clausen.
Admired for his skills in racing and remembered for his kindness, Brian Clausen will go down in history not only as a phenomenal race car driver, but also as a hero.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Memorial Day should be a happy time for veterans, but some of them dread the holiday because it brings back painful memories of their time on the battlefield. With help from family, friends, and counselors, veterans can get the help they need. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore has the story.
On Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day, this is what the holiday sounds like. But to a veteran, it can signal terror. Walter Gilliam is a Vietnam veteran. He knows the problem of post-traumatic stress disorder. When he got home from the war, it was a tough transition.
But when I first came home from Vietnam, don't touch me now. Don't try to wake me. Don't put your hands on me. Don't come up in here. Don't, you know. Mentally, I cannot readjust immediately. It took time.
For others, they never make the transition.
I had a neighbor that stayed behind where I lived, and on the 4th, on New Year's Eve, he would come out of the house and he would actually crawl on the ground, and he was a nervous wreck. We would have to go and console him and, you know, and talk to him and get him back to normal. He never got over that. He's still in Vietnam as far as his mental psyche is concerned.
The group called Military with Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder.org provides free signs for vets to put on their lawns on holidays so people who use fireworks can be mindful of the vet's condition. Dr. Claudio Altman is a psychologist with the Adam Benjamin Jr. VA Outpatient Clinic in Crown Point. He treats vets with PTSD.
It's actually very serious, and to the point where veterans actually start preparing for the 4th of July and the fireworks weeks and sometimes months in advance. So they might start re-engaging in psychotherapy months in advance in anticipation of the 4th of July. And so, and by the way, it's not just the 4th of July, but it's any celebration involving fireworks is so severe for them that they start building up anxiety towards that. Fireworks are first and foremost, a trigger. It is a trigger of anxiety. It is a reminder for them of some of the most scary experience they've ever had in their lives, which is being in combat. This is their life being in danger. And the thing with the fireworks is that it's an implicit memory, right? It's an implicit memory that means that it is unconscious. What happens is memory is not just pictures in our minds, but it's also physical. So the body remembers, and so that's the unconscious part. So when fireworks explode, fireworks are the closest sound you can find that reproduces an explosion, a rocket explosion. Small fires, small arm fires, right? Rockets, RPGs, and all that. So when the veteran hears that, for them, they relive, they re-experience the memory of having been there. And because it's a body, it's a physical reaction.
Dr. Altman advises vets to meet with your neighbors to explain your condition.
We would have to sometime go and catch him. He would come out the house, he'd be running naked and screaming. So some guys are actually able to leave Vietnam. Some guys, Vietnam never leave them. And he was one of those. He's the nicest guys you'd ever meet, but he's still in the service. A car backfire, he'll hit the ground and start crawling.
Some of his clients take a long fishing trip on holidays to get out of the situation altogether. In Crown Point, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. The last bison in Indiana was killed in the 1830s in French Lick, but in October 2016, the Nature Conservancy released 23 from a herd in South Dakota onto Kankakee Sands. Many of those cows are currently having calves. 9 have been born so far. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen talked with Kankakee Sands land manager Ted Anker about conservation efforts in Indiana. Here's that conversation.
Yep, you can see a calf right behind it now. If you look, it's walking to the right. It might be behind that autumn olive now. The color is so distinctive red. My name is Ted Anker. I'm the site manager here at the Kankakee Sands Restoration. It's owned and operated by the Indiana chapter of the Nature Conservancy. And so we're standing here overlooking our herd, and we've got 4 new calves in with the herd, and it's really exciting. So in 1996, we were able to purchase in a single acquisition 7,200 acres of land. You know, we're in the the northeast corner of what was the Tallgrass Prairie ecoregion in North America. And so this extended all the way out to the Plain States. And we're in this little tip, this little bit going all the way east into Indiana, into northern Indiana. We're here in what was historically interspersed Tallgrass Prairie.
Okay, this is a really cool map. Can we talk about this?
That's a neat one. The map is titled The Extermination of the American Bison. The map documents that historic range, so where they were at European settlement. And then it's got a number on each state, and that denotes the last year that bison were seen in that state. They were almost wiped out. There were about 1,000 left, down from about 60 million. The great news is that today, through conservation efforts and just through the production of bison for meat, there are about 500,000 animals in North America today. So we've got real hope and promise that we can preserve bison as a species. It's real exciting. Bison are a keystone species to prairies. 99% of the prairies in Indiana are gone. Even more rare than that is short grass prairie. We receive about 38 inches of rainfall here, and so that makes for very tall grasses, dominant grasses. Bison, it just so happens, eat about 90% grasses. And so bison, just by their nature, just by them eating and having bison calves and doing what bison do, they create short grass prairie for us and thereby benefit all those plants and animals. All the prairie species that are here, we brought the plants in, we built it. Over 600 species have been planted to date, so it's very diverse. And with that comes a whole suite of plants that we didn't plant, which was really interesting. A lot of orchid species find their way in on their own. We've done a couple plant surveys just last couple of years, and we've been amazed at what's come in by itself. And then we don't bring any animals in until bison. All the grassland birds, lizards, snakes, small mammals, they all found their way here on their own. And so I do this job basically for them. This area 20 years ago was all corn and beans, and today it's we've planted 600 species, but there's a lot more plant species out there. And like I said, almost all of the animal species came in on their own. So it's truly field of dreams type stuff. Build it and they will come. And every time you go out and you see something new that hasn't been documented on site, it's really exciting. You get a little adrenaline rush every time you do it because you know it's there due to our actions, due to the Nature Conservancy being here and putting all this really hard work into making this happen.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Upcoming graduations will cause an increase in traffic on many region roadways during the first week of June. Crown Point and Maryville High Schools will be hosting their respective graduations at the Star Plaza Theater off of US 30. Lakeshore Public Radio's Megan Hernandez has more.
Crown Point and Maryville High Schools will be hosting their respective graduations at the Star Plaza off of US 30. Maryville's graduation ceremony is expected to have over 2,200 people in attendance on Thursday, June 1st. With a heightened number of people on the road in addition to rush hour, traffic is expected to affect local highways I-65, US 30, and Delaware Street. Tuesday, June 6th will be a similar situation with over 2,400 expected to be at the Star Plaza for Crown Point's graduation. NDOT spokesman Doug Motes says the I-65 patching project between US 30 and the toll road southbound will cause some traffic headaches.
All traffic will be able to get through. They may experience some lane restrictions that might slow them down as they travel. So just allow yourself a little extra time as you travel to your venue and you should be okay.
Between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. on Thursday, June 1st, and Tuesday, June 6th, for anyone not attending the graduation ceremonies, it's recommended to take alternate routes and avoid heading towards the Star Plaza Theater. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Megan Fernandez.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Northwest Indiana voter rights and participation. Why should we care and engage in local politics? Is the focus of the next public forum facilitated by Lakeshore Public Radio at Purdue University Northwest's Hammond campus this Monday, June 5th. The free one-hour forum, also offered in partnership with the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area, begins at 5 p.m. in Alumni Hall on the third floor of the Student Union and Library, located on 2233 173rd Street. Chairs of Lake County's Republican Party, Dan Durnell, Democratic Party, James Weezer, and Libertarian Party, Michael Sandridge, head the forum's list of panel participants. They will be joined by other party members. Lakeshore Public Radio newscaster-broadcaster Chris Nolte will serve as the moderator. While the Trump presidency has made for a lively national political climate, this forum seeks to use that climate as a springboard for engaging and acquainting Northwest Indiana voters about issues that can impact their lives in Northwest Indiana. Lakeshore Public Media Vice President of Radio Operations Tom Maloney said, quote, "This forum is an opportunity to continue public dialogue and civil discourse about the impact of politics after an election," end quote. Community members are invited to attend and listen to local political leaders discuss the importance of voter participation in the election process. The forum will be recorded and broadcasted on Northwest Indiana Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, at noon, Tuesday, June 6th, on the station's regionally speaking program. St. Joseph's College has been closed for just under a month now, but what was it like for the students who were there at the time the historic institution came to such an abrupt ending? One of Lakeshore Public Radio's interns, Megan Fernandez, was a student at the time of the closing. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
You went to St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer, right?
Yes, for 2 years.
What were the years that you were there, and what was your major?
2015 and to 2017, and I was a double major, business administration, communications, and minoring in digital media and journalism.
Why did you choose St. Joseph's?
It was in the family. My oldest sister went there, and then my other oldest sister went there, and it was close to home, so it just seemed like a good fit.
What was it like being there as it was preparing to close?
It was pretty awful. Everyone was just sad and uncomfortable. No one really knew what to say. No one really knew how to act towards each other anymore. So I always told my family it was like walking around like at a funeral service because it just seemed sad.
Yeah, I mean, what was it like the vibe? Like, how did you feel? And what was a typical day like? Just the mood around there was sad?
The whole mood was sad. Some teachers talked about it, some teachers wouldn't. It was uncomfortable either way. Students really didn't talk about it, but right by the cafeteria every single day, there were a bunch of colleges trying to promote their schools, and no one really wanted to go there, but we all knew we had to, so it was just uncomfortable.
And then the teachers that did talk about it, what did they say?
A lot of the teachers would talk about their next step and what they're going through, and some teachers talked about how they felt about the whole situation and how they would help us if they could, or just their doors were open for us if we needed to talk to them.
Did it seem like the place was emptying out as you were there?
I would say the spirits were emptying out, but I mean, no one was leaving. Sometimes students would leave for college visits and come back, and sometimes teachers would go to interviews, so a lot of classes were canceled towards the end of the year, but no one was just leaving the school or anything.
So when was your last day on campus?
I was one of the last students there. I had to stay extra for track and field, and then even after that, I had to stay an extra day for a resident assisting closing the halls. So I watched everyone leave throughout the week, and I had to take their keys and close them out, and I had to say goodbye to the athletes once they finished their athletic career at St. Joseph's College. So I saw a lot of tears. I saw everyone's emotions. I saw the graduation. And it was all hard for every different type of student.
So you were a resident assistant at St. Joseph? You lived on campus?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. So you had a leadership role. What were you told by administration? Was there any sort of form letter, anything that they sent out? What was the word to what led up to it and what was happening?
Well, how I remember it is I was just running. It was just a normal day at cross-country practice or track practice at the time. And this girl was freaking out about the school's going to shut down and we don't even know if it's going to be around anymore. And another girl and I were kind of like, no, that's not true. That's not going to happen. We had no idea what she was talking about. But she was She talked a lot with, the president. She was in Student Association, was what it was called. And so it got kind of weird after that. I went to dinner, and this email got sent out. And it was all about how the school is $100 million in debt. And we had no idea that the school, everyone always said, like, the school is having money issues, the school is having money issues, but don't worry about it. It won't happen. Like, no effects will happen during your time. Like, you're never going to have to worry about it, is what we were told. So we were kind of like, okay. But then this email came out, and one of the seniors talked about how they had a meeting with the professors a week before saying how bad the money situation had gotten. And some of the professors had told the students, but they were all told not to tell the students, not to worry the students. So the students were kind of like, once we got the email about all this money, we kind of freaked out. We had a lot of anxiety. And the president that night said we could have a meeting with him. So he held the meeting, and it was just, he was very vague. He didn't like give a lot of, he didn't know a lot, I think was the issue. So he didn't know how to answer a lot of our questions. But one question was asked, and a student said, if I was your kid, would you tell me to start looking at other schools, to start transferring everything? And this president said, yes, you should. So that's when I walked out, because I was like, that's all I need to hear. And I just went and started making college visits. And then the answer from the board would come a week later, and the answer was that it was going to shut down. So after that, we only got a week. That week was awful, but we got a week. And then the final answer was that we would finish out the semester, and that would be it.
Do you remember the day, what the date was when the word came down?
Yep, it was February 3rd.
So what are you going to do now?
I'm going to Valparaiso this fall, and I'll be, I don't know what my major will be anymore. It's going to change, but I'll hopefully be graduating in 2 years or have to tack on like an extra semester.
Will you be living on campus at Valparaiso, and will you be an RA there?
That's the hope. I'm going to be living there for the first year and try to be an RA, and if not, I'll just be staying at home for my last year.
So you're a junior now?
Yes.
Were you told anything about the future of St. Joseph? What's going to happen in the short term?
No, there are a lot of rumors, but there hasn't been a definite, this is what's going to happen to St. Joseph's College.
What do you think's going to happen?
I think something's going to buy it out, because there's a lot of nice buildings there, and it would just go to waste if not. But I don't know who's going to buy it out.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Don Parker, vice president and governance chair of the South Shore Orchestra, about the upcoming performance of Primal Roots.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Don Parker, who is a celebrated area musician. Aren't you?
Oh, that's celebrated. I don't know about that.
Oh, everybody celebrates when you play, Don. And you play with a lot of different ensembles and for a lot of musicals at different theaters.
Yes.
But you're very involved with the South Shore Orchestra,
yes,
which is headquartered in Valparaiso.
Yes, sir.
And you perform a lot at Memorial Opera House.
That's our home base now, has been the last couple of years, and we're just delighted about that partnership.
Yeah, that's a good place for you. Do you have you been affiliated with the orchestra since it was founded?
I have been. That's about 15 years now.
Okay.
Yes.
And you travel to China?
Five tours we have done. I've only been on three. And two of those were full orchestral tours of major cities on the coast. And the third one was when we took a 1940s style big band swing musical to China as well. That was an those were amazing trips.
Yeah. How long were you there on average?
About 11 days each time. Yes. Over the Christmas break.
Yeah. That's great. And you're going to go again this coming year.
I will not be. The orchestra will be.
I see.
But yes, I will not be.
Yeah.
Too many other places left to go to.
I see. So you've been there, done that, literally.
Yes. Yeah.
So the orchestra has a big concert coming up on June the 2nd.
Friday night, June the 2nd at 7:30 at the Opera House in Valparaiso.
And it's modern classical.
Our whole season this year is going to be focusing on more modern or modernist pieces of music. And so the program is three works, one by Dmitri Shostakovich, Russian composer, 20th century, called The Festive Overture. It's pretty well known to the concert-going audiences. A piece called Concerto Gregoriano by Respighi, also a 20th century Italian composer. That's with a solo violin. Our soloist is Violetta Todorova. and finally Philip Glass's Symphony No. 10, which was only composed 5 years ago in 2012.
And you were telling me that there's a special abhorrence that composers have with regard to their 10th symphonies.
There is a superstition among composers. Many composers died before completing their 10th symphonies for whatever reason. And so Glass actually finished and premiered his 10th symphony prior to finishing and premiering his 9th symphony, evidently because he was concerned about that superstition.
Mm-hmm. Shostakovich, is this a particularly difficult piece for the orchestra to perform?
I would say no. It's very it's rather structured and precise, and so and it moves, most of it moves very fast, and so the challenge is just making sure that the ensemble is playing really cleanly as this really fast moving music goes along.
And Respighi, he did Pines of Rome, didn't
yes.
he?
Yes, Fountains of Rome, Pines of Rome.
That's kind of lyrical
yes,
music.
Yes, a more lyrical piece. And the difference for this is it has some surprising areas where the meter changes. So it's not a steady 1-2, mm-hmm. 1-2. Every once in a while it's a 1-2-3 that's just thrown in, you know, something like
right.
that.
So the Glass is the most difficult piece for...
Far and away. It's one of the most difficult pieces we've ever played in this orchestra. And it is a very modern style. Like some pieces of music are not terribly musical, but this one is. You still get the tunefulness of it. But it has, as I said to you earlier in my memo, it has... it's waves and walls and currents of music, and it's very hypnotic. It's an enchanting piece of music.
And in addition to the regular adult concert that you have on the 2nd of June, you have children's concerts on May 24th this week.
We're playing our second year of children's concerts at the Memorial Opera House for area second graders, and we're really delighted to be able to do that. That's a complete partnership that we have with them.
Well, that's great. How many students will be able to attend?
So far, it looks like two full concerts of about 350 each, so mm-hmm. about 700 kids
will
be able to serve. Yep.
That's really – I think it's exciting for little kids to get to go hear a live concert
yep.
performed by real musicians. And I mean, they're not even necessarily familiar. And this is Peter and the Wolf.
Peter and the Wolf.
So it's delightful.
And it's a very accessible piece to kids, exactly.
Yeah. And they get to learn about instruments.
Yep.
I loved that on television when I was little. So, okay, well, great, Don. Thank you for being here to tell us about the upcoming concerts. Good luck with them.
And my pleasure. Thank you.
Just keep on playing.
Will do.
And we'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
As we approach Memorial Day, regionally speaking host Chris Nolte talked with Karen Lloyd, a retired Army colonel who is the director of Veterans History Project. It is part of the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center that collects, preserves, and makes accessible the personal accounts of U.S. war veterans so that their stories live on. She is encouraging individuals and groups to contribute photos, letters, or diaries of deceased veterans and to record conversation with those still living. And Karen will offer more information on how to do this.
I think it's so important that we make sure that our veterans know and understand how much we think of the fact that they've chosen to give time and selfless service for our country, but especially important that we think about those that gave their lives in defense of our country and our freedoms that we are able to enjoy today. And one of the ways is to, if the vet happens to be with you still, is to chat with them and have a conversation with them. And it doesn't have to go right to what'd you do in the war, but rather... what was your service like, and what was the best part? Because sometimes we discover, and I was one of them, those reluctant veterans that said I was a part of a team,
mm-hmm.
and I really didn't do anything. And I would suggest to you that if you can start asking those kinds of questions, veterans will open up and tell you what their story was like, and every veteran has one. And they all walk into it saying, well, I didn't. I'm guilty of that same thing. When I did my interview, I thought, boy, if I get 30 minutes, I'm going to be lucky. And I didn't want to embarrass myself. And 2.5 hours later, and it felt like 10 minutes, I told things I had not thought about in such a long time. the good parts and the bad parts.
If you will, Karen, tell us a little bit more about the Veterans History Project. How did it get started, and where does it stand today on how many people have been involved in the conversations?
Well, we have over 100,000 collections, and we're very excited about that. But when you think that there's 17 to 20 million veterans in the country today, we're just scratching the surface, and we're asking for volunteers all across the nation to get involved and talk with the veterans in their life. And where what we bring to the table is we bring a field kit that tells how to do it and what you need, but mostly you need volunteers that are willing to take the time to listen to their veterans. We've got a multitude of different ways to reach us. We've got a website, loc.gov/vets. We have email, vohp@loc.gov. We have a Facebook page, /vets with an S, History Project. We're on Twitter at #LOCVets, and we have a toll-free line. We are here to help. We can send out local historians to teach workshops if that's what you need to be more comfortable. Our website not only has the field kit, but it has a video on how to do it. And it's part of it's getting that oral history so you don't lose the voice, but it's also about getting the pictures and the diaries and the letters so that there's a full picture of this veteran. And what their life of service was like, and the folks that were in there in their lives.
How is the History Project different from other memorials or other monuments that might be out there to remember people on not only a Veterans Day but Memorial Day?
We believe that the Veterans History Project is what keeps these voices alive. We think this is where people can go to hear the real story of what selfless service was all about. So often when you hear about or you read books or you go to movies and it's about the backdrop is a particular war, but what brings you in and makes you want to stay are the stories of those veterans. And those stories in those movies didn't get there. They got there only because veterans chose to tell their story about what it was like, their selfless service. So we're asking folks across the country to become part of this volunteer corps with us to help to get more veteran stories.
Will you please share a story from the archive to give our listeners an opportunity to find out more?
I sure will. There's one that I particularly like. He was a staff sergeant. His name is Homer Hall. He hailed from Kansas, and he was with the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment in the 82nd. And on Normandy, he dropped in behind the lines, and he didn't drop in the right place. But as a sergeant, he went around finding other soldiers that didn't drop in the right place, banded them together, about 15 of them, and created hate and discontent back behind the lines in Normandy for about a week before he got caught and was sent to be a POW. And what's so unique about what he chose to do was, while he was a POW, he made a diary. He took cigarette labels. He took canned food labels and old maps to write about what was going on. He taught himself Spanish. I can't imagine why Spanish, because when we checked out where his Stalag Luft was, it was in Poland. So he moved from Normandy to Poland. And then we also have supplementary documentation that his wife wrote about what her life was like while he was downrange and in service and serving as a POW as well. And so we have those types of amazing stories that are awfully fun to hear. We have another one from World War One, World War Two, where a wife and husband correspond, and they've been married 5 months, and they are the best letters in the whole world. But what's so sad about this particular collection is that starts not feeling well, goes to the doctor, they discover he's got leukemia. They don't have a name for the disease, but they knew that they were getting him out of theater. So he writes her and says, "I've gone to the doctor. They said that I'm going to be coming home. I've got some serious disease." She writes this amazingly romantic letter that he never receives because he dies before he receives it.
Oh my goodness!
And what's really special about that collection is that they chose to give us. I don't know if you're familiar with the veteran flag that you fly with the blue stars on the white background when you have service members downrange.
Yeah, in fact, I think my mother even had one in the window when I was in the service years ago.
There you go. Well, they had three members in the service, and they took one of the blue stars and covered it with gold material in the shape of a star and sewed it on. And that is so impactful, along with these amazing letters. And what really makes me nervous is, if you think about the last 30 years, really since Vietnam, we've been doing everything by email and by Skype. And where are all of these correspondence between our veterans that were downrange and their families that were back home? My fear is that they're lost. Mm-hmm. And I would ask veterans and their families to think about and what they did with that information, and if they still have it, print out some copies and keep it, because those are the love letters that are we're losing day by day.
We're talking with Karen Lloyd, who is the director of the Veterans History Project. And on this Memorial Day, we're looking at opportunities to get individuals and groups of individuals together to record some of the important conversations and thoughts of our veterans still around, and to remember them on this day that we typically set aside for those who have given their lives in service of their country. Karen, you were talking about the opportunity to be able to record these conversations, about having a kit that you can get when you sign up online and get more information here. How easy is it to record a veteran's conversation?
If you have a smartphone, you can record their history. It's that simple. And again, we can give you sample questions that you can download. We've got lots of different ways for you to contact us if you have any concerns about it. We are here to help you. We can Skype with you if you want to do a one-to-one. We also, again, have oral historians that will come out and teach a workshop if you have a group of 25 or more that are interested in talking to the veterans in your life, so we don't lose their voices.
Now, we're based here in Northwest Indiana, and we know that the Veterans History Project is a project that's involved with the Library of Congress. Do you have regional representatives, as you mentioned, staff members that can go out and help people get these conversations set up? Can you tell us how the setup is if somebody wants to come in? A group brings in some people to be able to get the Veterans History Project going here.
Exactly. What we would ask you to do is to contact us, and we will contact a local oral historian or folklorist, and they will come and teach a class to the group and talk to them about the best ways to go about doing oral histories. And it would be, we'd ask that the group put together a site so that the oral historian can come and teach the class there. I mean, that's one of the things we do. We also have an opportunity, if you'll contact us, we can Skype how to go about it, what are some best practices. We work with numerous congressional offices and help them manage collecting the local histories. Senator Rich Lugar, Senator Lugar did an amazing job in Indiana of reaching out. In fact, Indiana is our best state. They had over 4,700,000 veterans, and we've got over 9,000, so they are by far our best state.
Wow.
And so it can be done, and we would just ask you to, one, be willing to spend the time as a volunteer and then reach out to us. Again, there's multiple different ways to reach out to us so that we can help you make a difference.
And if you will, again, give us those web addresses and other information, too, and also, too, where people can take a look at some of these veteran stories, like the two that you just relayed to us.
Yes. Our website is loc.gov/vets, and 40% of our collections are online. So just go to our website and click, and you can search by name, you can search by state, you can search by unit, you can search by service, lots of different choices there, so that you can kind of go down, you know, really search down to the one that means the most to you. Our email is vohp@loc.gov. We're on Facebook at Vets with an S, History Project. We're on Twitter, #LOCVets with an S. And we have a toll-free number, 888-371-5848. And I would be remiss if I didn't reach out to the Gold Star families and ask them to think about giving their reminiscences of their veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Congress just passed a law last fall, which now allows us, the Gold Star families, to reach out to us and give us their reminiscences and reflections, so that we'll have a greater depth and sense of each of these veterans.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition from NPR News with local host Sharon Jackson on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.